specialization. And in doing comparisons of what I felt was the fundamental tenets of a Mormon ethic with all the traditional utilitarian thought, formalist thought, the ethics folks in religious studies, etc., I ran across a phenomenon that really didn't surprise me, but there is not very much literature existing in the world that has been written by moral philosophers with any kind of an LDS bent. So at that time I decided to start sifting through whatever I could, writing letters to various individuals, and I found that there were maybe 10 to 15 articles and one book, well actually two books, but one specifically in ethics, that had been written by individuals with some kind of LDS background. So in 8 years, I collected those, and they appeared early this spring in a volume that Bookcraft is distributing called Perspectives in Mormon Ethics. And so that is really the springboard of this particular panel. And before I move further, I should apologize. One of our panel members called late last night and will not be here. Don Sorensen had a death in his family and had to attend to the responsibilities surrounding that death. So Kent Robson is with us. Kent is the professor and chairman of the Languages and Philosophy Department at Utah State. Lynn Wardle is with us also. Lynn is a contributor to the volume in medical ethics. Lynn is an associate professor of law at the law school at BYU. Now, I attempted to find some individuals that had not contributed to the book. Some of the articles were reprints, some were new, solicited by request. So Kent will be the only individual that has an unbiased point of view. And Kent and I have known to lock horns in the past on some moral issues, but we'll proceed. Kent will speak first, followed by Lynn. And we had hoped, because we felt it would be an intimate group here, that we would have plenty of time for question and answers, which I feel that we will have. So, Kent?
It really is a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to speak about this very handsome volume, Perspectives in Mormon Ethics, that has just been recently published by Publishers Press. It's distributed by Bookcraft, and edited, of course, by Don Hill, an anthology of writings on Mormon ethics. I'd like to suggest that this really is a singular accomplishment. Several years ago, Mormons began to be interested in history. And you can see that through the work of the Mormon History Association and Sunstone, and the work of publishers, the level of writing in Mormon history has enormously turned upward, and the volume of material being published is now both substantial and interesting. About 10 years ago now, after Sunstone Magazine had been founded, I suggested to Peggy Fletcher that it was really a crying shame that theological issues had never been addressed in the church, and Peggy took it upon herself to try to remedy that problem by instituting these annual Sunstone Theological Symposia, and as a result, theological issues are now being addressed very widely. More and more articles are finding them their way into publications such as Dialogue and Sunstone, Exponent 2, and some other places. BYU Studies, there are a number of outlets now. But Don is correct, in my view, when he suggests that this is really an unusual volume. Now, I'd like to suggest to you that it is a mislabeled volume. I think Don would immediately agree to this. The title is Perspectives in Mormon Ethics. Nobody knows what a Mormon ethic ought to be. Nobody has articulated a Mormon ethic. I think it would have been more accurately titled Perspectives by Mormons About Ethics and a Wide Variety of Contemporary Ethical Issues. Also, the book is a rather interesting collection of a wide variety of articles, many of which were not written for inclusion in this book itself. Articles that say nothing whatsoever about Mormonism, some on Catholic theology and some on other issues. However, it is interesting to me that all of the writers are Mormon, and I think it is impossible for them to bring to bear on some of their work some of their Mormon values. Don and I have been disagreeing for some time as to what the outlines of a Mormon ethic ought to be. My own predisposition would run in more Kantian terms, his in utilitarian terms. I have some very serious suspicions about an ethic based simply on utilitarian ethical doctrine. It may be that Don has some similar reservations about a Kantian perspective. In any case, that ethic has never been stated by anyone from a Mormon point of view. In fact, I'm not sure that there is anyone around these days who could be called preeminent Mormon ethicist. There are people who are, of course, very interested in ethics and who teach ethics and do some writing in ethics, but this is a pioneering effort. And I think that's one of the things that you should understand about this very handsome volume. I'd like to make some general remarks and then some specific remarks about the essays in the volume. The general remarks are these. It seems to me that within the context of Mormon theology, there are some theological issues that bear on the outlines of a Mormon ethic. I'm not sure that they have always been appreciated, and I'm not sure that I'm willing to say just which ones they are and how they bear, but I'd like to give at least one indication of that. I think that the Mormon ethic tends to be, as one writer described in talking about justice among nations, more idealist than realist. And it tends to be a little bit, in my view, absolutist as opposed to relativistic. And in fact, I like that. I think that in my view, the ethical theorizing, not only in Mormonism but elsewhere that I see in the world, is heavily influenced by a kind of relativist perspective that I consider somewhat dangerous, because there are a lot of people who are willing to tolerate and include anything and call it ethics. Now, I'm willing to call it casuistry, but not ethics. There are even some essays in this volume that hint at relativism. And yet, in one and the same essay, notably the very first essay by E. E. Erickson, there are suggestions of relativism and suggestions of a kind of stable absolutism in one and the same essay. The controversies remind me of the situation that Plato dealt with when he and his mentor Socrates came on the scene. It seems to me that their orientation was heavily ethical. They were concerned about the sophists, the teachers of wisdom, who claimed that that if you could teach well, if you could learn rhetoric well, and there is an issue on that very issue in the volume, and you could carry the day, it didn't make any difference what you said. Any position was as good as any other position, as long as you were very persuasive. Now, in that context, both Socrates and his pupil Plato seem to me to have argued that there are some positions that are correct and reliable and trustworthy, and not only that, they don't change. They are continuous. And one ought to try to identify what they are. It may be that in this life, at least this was Plato's view, we will never be able to capture precisely what they are. Over and over again in the Platonic dialogues, Plato talks about justice, and he talks about piety, and he talks about pleasure, but he never arrives at the definitive interpretation of what these are. But he thinks that there is such a thing, and that if we could find it, it would be very important. Now, it's that anti-relativistic sentiment in Plato that I happen to like very much. And that brings me to some specific comments on some of the articles. In a rather interesting essay by Truman Madsen, in which he tries to find the perspectives of Joseph Smith that relate to ethics, and see how they do match up. One of the things that he suggests is that Joseph Smith strongly believes that ethical values are discovered and not proclaimed. Not proclaimed. That is, they are not simply dished out by authority from the church or even from God. That the values are values once and for all. They are part, if you like, of the furniture of the universe. Now, Truman gets this idea primarily, I think, from the King Follett Discourse, and I happen to agree with him. I think that that was Joseph Smith's view. In that context, I found Don Hill's contribution to this volume interesting, in which he discusses the Platonist dilemma that you find in the Euthyphro dialogue. It's an incredibly interesting dilemma. It's one that I spoke about in the Sunstone Symposium 3 or 4 years ago. The dilemma is this. Plato asked the question, do the gods love piety because it is pious, or is it pious because the gods love it? Now, on the first assumption, there is something that is independently and really pious or holy, and the gods would have to discover that and abide by it the same as anyone else would. And on the other horn, or is it pious because the gods love it? Do the gods, by fiat, bring it into existence? Do they say that it comes to exist, and that it exists because they say so? That they simply announce whatever moral commands they want to announce. Thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, and so on. But since the gods may be all-powerful, at least that's a standard Christian assumption, if the gods happen to change their minds, and they could change their minds, then whatever they change their minds to would become the standard at that time. So that the only thing that is wrong with adultery in this view is that the gods say, thou shalt not commit adultery. But the gods are all powerful, or God is, if you like. If Plato was speaking in the plural, of course. The only thing wrong with adultery is that the gods have prohibited. But if they change their mind, then by divine fiat, adultery would be quite all right. Now, some people have wanted to add that they're not going to change their mind because God is an unchanging God. But William of Ockham, back in the Middle Ages, insisted that the important thing was that God could change his mind, and that the only thing that made adultery, and he discussed that explicitly, wrong, was that God said that it was wrong. Now, Joseph Smith's view is contrary to that. And Joseph Smith's view was that that the gods discover some of those values. They just don't invent them. They don't bring them into existence by their command. They discover what is valuable in much the same way as they discover the chaos which they organize to make the world. Now, I was somewhat surprised by Don's essay because he failed to mention what Plato's own solution was. Plato's solution was that the gods discover it, that what is pious or holy is holy completely independent of the gods. It's not dependent on God to announce what is holy. And he took the other horn of the dilemma, namely that they simply announce that, and looked at Graeber's argument for that view. He made some very nice criticisms against Graeber, but Graeber, in arguing against people like Flew and so on, who have said that that position is untenable, Don ends up trying to find a position that is not Graeber's position, but it almost appeared to me that he wanted to be on that horn of the dilemma. Now, I'm not sure where he ended up on this overall position. Is goodness or piety or justice or truth independent of God, or is it dependent on God? And I'm not sure where he ends up. Maybe he'll tell us exactly. It wasn't clear to me. He didn't like Graeber's suggestion exactly, but he was arguing on that horn. Plato takes the other one, the one that Joseph Smith takes, namely that the values are eternal values and independent of God, and God had to discover them the same as everybody else did. Now, one of the several of the essays in the book had nothing to say about Mormonism whatsoever, nothing to do with Mormonism. An essay by Lou Midgley, for example, talked about Catholic theology recently discovering the importance of revelation and prophecy over against reason in the natural law tradition. Now, I must confess that I'm not entirely comfortable with his wanting to discredit the natural law or the natural reason tradition. That tradition has undergone substantial change, but I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with this idea that divine fiat is the answer also. You can understand why I'd be uncomfortable with that for the reason that I just gave, looking at this Platonic dilemma. Now, it may be that what Lou wanted to say was simply that we ought to use both traditions together. And if that's what he wants to say, that's quite all right with me. But if he wants to say that the only thing that we need is prophecy, that I'm not sure that prophecy gives us all of the fleshing out of the information that we need to live our lives in an ethical perspective. There was a very, very interesting essay that I like very much by Noel Reynolds on the enforcement of morals. This is an extremely big and interesting topic. You may be aware that not only in England, but in the United States as well, there has been an attitude for some time to either enact more permissive legislation or to tacitly allow a whole lot of additional practices to continue as long as they meet the principle of John Stuart Mill,
without any kind of legal enforcement. I'm thinking of things such as homosexuality, prostitution, beach, and any number of other such things. The basic idea in Mill's principle is that you ought to let consenting adults who do what they do generally in private do whatever they want to do, as long as it doesn't harm anyone else. And it's an extremely appealing doctrine, and one wants to modify the Millian principle only with very great caution. However, Noel Reynolds discusses Lord Bevin's reply to John Stuart Mill and the continuing discussion between Devlin and Hart and Dworkin and others. And this is one of the few essays in which somebody argues on the side of Devlin, because Dworkin and Hart take Mill's side that we ought to let anybody do whatever they want, wherever and whenever they want to do it, as long as they're consenting adults, that is, and they do it in private, and there are some other safeguards, and not prohibit it. Now, I worry about that view, as does Reynolds, and it does seem to me that drug usage, even if it's done by adults in private, can harm other people, and that's one of the places where you can get your nose under the camel's tent and raise trouble for Mill's principle. It's really hard to say that prostitution doesn't harm others as well, that in some cases homosexuality may not, and pornography and many other such things. According to the Millian principle, which I guess I would have to judge in empirical terms, based upon what legislatures have done, what the courts have done in recent years, has been the preeminent principle. They've been making decisions and taking actions that would hardly prohibit anything without regard for what bearing that has on the overall structure of the society. Well, let me go on. There's a marvelous call for responsibility by Dallin Oaks in the dedication of the law school at Brigham Young University, in which he insists that the lawyers there ought to have a religious commitment, they ought to emphasize religious values, concern for ethics, and so on. And then immediately after it is an article by Doug Parker of the law school, which I found to be the most disturbing and the most irritating article in the whole volume, because the basic assumption by Parker in that essay is that all human relationships are manipulative relationships. He uses, this may not be well known to those of you who have not studied philosophy, but he uses an old book by A.J. Ayer, Language, Truth, and Logic, and the dichotomy of the kinds of sentences that one can use and how one can use them, and ends up with an emotive theory of ethics, which strikes me as flat out wrong, a theory that was espoused by Ayer, or at least it's half wrong. It was espoused by Ayer and Charles Louis Stevenson of the University of Michigan more recently. But he thinks that rhetoric is simply to persuade people, and that all persuasion is manipulation. And the nice thing about it is, however, that in rhetoric, we allow other people to have their position to try to persuade us back, and that's the good thing about it, because there is some equity. I like the equity all right enough, but I must admit that I was very disturbed by his basic assumption that all human relationships are manipulative and that all ethics is emotive, either expressing our emotions to other or trying to evoke emotions from other, which is A.J. Ayer's initial position. That's not to say that the study of rhetoric is not an interesting and informative topic. There's an interesting article by Richard Sherlock, who is, I think, one of the very bright and promising young Mormon scholars. He's now at Fordham University. I would recommend to you that you always keep a sharp eye out for Richard Sherlock's work. It's very good. He has an interesting essay on abortion and the problems of discussing the abortion issue and trying to find a constitutional amendment to deal with the Supreme Court's decision on abortion in Roe versus Wade that would be fair and interesting. I found the most interesting part of his essay not to be the part where he is discussing the appropriateness of the arguments themselves for and against abortion, but the more interesting part of that essay to be the part where he talks about the constitutional problem of trying to do something about abortion if you happen to be opposed to it. The essays are a mixed bag. There is an essay on entitled Decision Models in Bioethics, and what it is primarily a way of trying to deal with the whole problem of death and dying, trying to decide how we ought to address those kinds of problems, and I think it's helpful. Not theoretically very interesting, but helpful as a kind of pragmatic way of trying to look at all of the issues that are involved in making decisions for ourselves and for others in death and dying situations. And finally, an interesting article by Lynn Wardle on passive euthanasia. Now, Lynn Wardle, who's going to speak next, is in the law school at Brigham Young University. I learned by listening to one of his talks in the Sunstone Symposium on abortion, Joe, that he was a young scholar also to pay attention to and to be reckoned with. And I would recommend to you that you pay careful attention to the work that he puts out, because it's always of high quality. In his article, he makes three claims. One is that in some cases, passive euthanasia could be ethically justified. Two, that the law shouldn't justify it. It shouldn't write codes or provisions into the law allowing passive euthanasia, but simply keep its hands off. And three, he discusses a kind of Mormon perspective on whether passive euthanasia ought to be acceptable or accepted. It seemed to me that I can agree entirely with what he says about the Mormon perspective. I agree entirely that the law shouldn't justify passive euthanasia, that it ought to keep its hands off, but I don't think that he at all justified his claim that that passive euthanasia was in fact ethically justifiable in some cases. Now, that's not to say that someone might not be able to make that argument, that one might be able to claim that it is ethically justifiable in some cases. But I don't think Lynn has done it quite yet in this essay. All in all, however, it's a fascinating first volume in ethics written by Mormons. It's not in Mormon ethics, as I said, but ethics written by Mormons. And this is a singular pioneering effort. Let me just reiterate that the progress made by Mormon historians on Mormon history has been spectacular. The progress made by those interested in theology on Mormon theology has been interesting, but this is the first effort ever to make any progress at all on issues by Mormons discussing ethics, trying to bring some values of Mormons to bear on those essays, and it's something that is somewhat difficult reading, but it deserves your careful review. Thank you.
I was honored to be invited to participate in this symposium. I'm Lynn Wardle. Don Hill called me, and Don is a friend, and I think that probably overshadows his judgment in many cases. A few random thoughts at the outset. As Kent did, I'd like to encourage this book not because I have an essay in it. I mentioned to Kent having written the essay about 3 years ago, and then last year being told that it was going to be published, so I needed to rewrite it quickly again, or at least edit it. And then doing that very quickly and looking at it when it came out, I was chagrined that there were weaknesses that I would like to have a chance to go back. I'd like to have a big eraser and go back and rewrite it substantially in many ways, for substance as well as in some cases form. But this is a book that I would recommend, and I think Don Hill deserves a great deal of credit, not just credit because he's the editor, but because of the great initiative that he's taken. Don is someone whose real interest in application is in intellectual discussion, willingness to face controversial topics, hard topics, and talk about them and write about them. I think that he does that because he believes, as I do, that there is merit in the interchange of ideas, that there's progress, and that people improve as they hear other positions and try to come to grips with them, try to find the fallacy or the flaw, and that helps them also to become more critical thinkers in their own approaches. Don really pursued in this. It took several years, and it took a substantial investment out of his own pocket, and an investment that he hopes to recoup, and I do too. This book, I understand, isn't available here today. It's an incredible oversight. To me, it's an astounding oversight that with all the books that are available and all the good literature, somehow Bookcraft and somehow Deseret Book and whoever else would be responsible forgot to pick this one up. But if you're interested, I'm sure Don would be able to tell you where you can get it or provide you with a copy. I feel a little awkward being here because I'm a lawyer. I'm not a philosopher, not an ethicist really. I'm not trained in that field. In fact, the only course in philosophy I ever took, I dropped out from when I was a freshman in college. I didn't drop out. I ought to clarify, I liked the course very much, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was the best course I had that semester, and I still remember it, an excellent course. But I got a mission call, and this was during the Vietnam War, and they had slots back in those days, if you'll remember. Each ward could send out 2 missionaries, and if they didn't complete their quota, we're going to send 2, then the state could take the remainders. And I had a birthday coming at the end of the year, and one ward had an extra slot, and they said, if you're willing to take it, we'd like to process your paperwork, and they did, and my mission call came, and I was to be in the mission home 15 days after the letter got there. So I had to drop out of the course and never return. Well,
does
it? Well, I dropped out of the course to my regret, and I say that. That's a long diversion, but the point I want to make is that I am not trained. I recognize a shortcoming there. Enjoy reading in this area and talking with people like Kent and like Don. Appreciate Kent's courtesy and generosity. I have a great deal of respect for him, having heard him speak at several symposia before, and realize that he's well-informed and a man of good judgment. I teach a course in biomedical ethics and law at BYU Law School. I misstated that. I offer a course. I don't teach one. It's a seminar, and we do a whole lot of reading, and we do a lot of discussing, and I require the students to write a lot of papers, which I enjoy reading, and which I, because I am the professor in the course, grade. But it's not much of a teaching experience, because I don't feel that I'm qualified to teach on the ethics. But I would like to use ethics in a broader sense, perhaps a pedestrian, man-on-the-street sense, because that's the approach that I the level at which I can feel confident, and that is ethics as conformity with a rule or standard that's accepted by a particular group. In that sense, there is legal ethics. There is medical ethics. There is, that is, the ethics of a particular profession. What is right and what is wrong is determined by the authority within that profession. or using it in a colloquial sense. Something is ethical, we would say, if it is moral, or if we think in society at large that it's right or acceptable conduct. I think that there is a great ferment, a lot of ethical discussion, and a lot of ethical discourse in the country at large today, not limited to philosophers and ethicists, but in the newspapers, a great deal of discussion of ethical dilemmas. One of them that comes to mind very recently, area that I'm interested in, is life and death and regulation and protection of life and death, abortion and euthanasia and death with dignity and in vitro fertilization and surrogate motherhood. Many of you may have read in the newspaper just about a month ago of the fascinating dilemma that now exists. It's a real life dilemma. It's an incredible hypothetical. A wealthy couple. It doesn't state their nationality, but they have a Spanish surname, and they are from Chile. So I assume they are Chileans, living in California, Southern California. He is the husband, has done very well, and has an estate of more than $1 million. They have a 9-year-old daughter. The daughter dies in a tragic death. The mother is distraught. They cannot have more children. Naturally, and so they go to a clinic in Australia where in vitro fertilization is done, and they harvest two ova from the woman and sperm from the man and fertilize the ova and then freeze them. They have two, I guess we would call them technically zygotes, two fertilized ova that are at some stage of early development that are now frozen. And as you know, they can thaw these, and they can and have developed. In fact, there was just a birth a short time ago in the papers of a beautiful little child that was the first frozen embryo to be thawed and then implanted and developed. The woman is so emotionally, though unstable or distraught, I guess in part owing to the death of the child, that they decide not to try the implantation of that at that time. They go back to the United States, and on a trip somewhere else, I forget where they are, I guess it's in San Diego, the airplane, flying his own airplane, crashes and they both die, no other children. Tremendous number of questions. As a conflict of laws teacher, the first one is, what law governs what question? What are the issues? I thought this would be a marvelous law exam to give students and just say, okay, you've got 45 minutes to identify all the issues. Don't write on it. Just identify the issues. And, of course, one of the prominent questions is, shall they wash the Petri dish? If so, who makes that decision, or can that decision be made? And you can see that it's not an abstract question, but a real question, and that there are, in terms of things that make a great difference in the law, to it, dollars and cents, there's a great deal at stake and a lot of interest, because there is an estate out there, $1 million-plus estate. Well, that's the kind of issue that's raised in a newspaper. You open the newspaper and you read questions like that, or the woman who, the surrogate mother, illegal, not legal in all states. Nowhere has it been legalized. It's done, even though it's not legal, questionable validity, but done in many states now, and the woman who undertakes to bear a child for a married man, a man married to another woman whose wife cannot bear, changes her mind and says, I'm going to keep the child. Questions about biomedical ethics and treatment for children. The baby Jane Doe case, again, just very recently, I guess it was last winter or spring, back in New York, with the little girl that was born with a small head with a spina bifida, and the question of whether the parents could override or decline, refuse the treating pediatricians and neurosurgeons' recommendation for immediate aggressive treatment, which would reduce the chance of infection. Of course, infection is associated with mental retardation irreversibly. And great controversy that arose from that. Well, those kinds of issues arise frequently. Now, the thing that is on my mind, and I didn't want to review, my article deals with passive euthanasia, and I don't intend to say anything about that. but what I intend to say would apply to discussion of that. I'm concerned that this has been on my mind for some time, and I think this is a forum which I can speak about it freely, very candidly. And that is the problem of integrity in ethical debate. I'm very, very troubled by what I consider to be the manipulation of facts, the manipulation in argument, in rhetoric, if you will. People who are afraid to or unwilling to, whether they're afraid to or not, for whatever purpose, to come to grips with the difficult problems. I think the issue that I'm probably the most familiar with, on which I've done the greatest amount of research and writing, is abortion. And probably in that area there is as much or more kind of dishonesty as there is in any other area. And it's dishonesty on both sides of the question. But one that troubles me is that the very fundamental, the very threshold question, does abortion involve the taking of human life? I am a little perturbed, quite irritated, in fact, at the disingenuous arguments that are used to avoid coming to grips with the realities and the facts of the case. I think there are people that look down the line and say, well, now, if we admit X, that's going to impair, that's going to make it more difficult to reach the conclusion we want to reach. So we will deny X. We will gloss over X. We will be dishonest. Perhaps they don't say that, but let me give you an example. Question of whether an abortion destroys a human life. Let me just use those terms. Heard a man that I respect and really do respect, an awfully good lawyer, prominent man in the legal community, a very good man, talked the other day about how he didn't, when I was growing up, we didn't think life began until birth, or at least after birth. And it seemed to me that that's an awfully incredible statement to be making in 1980, that a refusal to recognize the life in being or the life in utero. If I recall, medical science discovered the fact and the reality of life in utero back in the 18th century. In fact, if you want to go into the history of abortion laws in America, it was the American Medical Association that lobbied very hard in the 1860s, the late 1850s actually, 1859, to encourage the updating and the revision, the amending of the current abortion laws in order to take account of the fact that the unborn was alive from the time of conception, fertilization. That was because the common law, the unwritten common law, which had been in effect for hundreds of years, they have cases going back to the 13th century, prohibited abortion in the case of a quick fetus. And that was based on their understanding in the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, that life didn't begin until quickening, and it was a quickening when the spirit was infused. That concept changed when the common law was reduced in the great codification era of the early 19th century, reduced to codes and statutes. That was the law that was written down. Abortion was prohibited after quickening. And then some doctors who began to look at the laws and say, well, this is a little bit silly, because we now discover in our great modern age of scientific knowledge that the fetus is alive from the time of conception. It's a living being from the time of conception. And so there is, it seems to me, a disingenuous kind of refusal to come to grips with that, which is quite inconsistent with what's going on in terms of in vitro fertilization, in terms of embryo surgery, and so forth. It was the AMA, as I said, a Horatio Storer, a doctor who was also a lawyer, who chaired a committee in about 1857, reported to the AMA and said, look, we recognize there's a great discrepancy because the law doesn't prohibit abortion until quickening, and we all know that the embryo is, and the fetus is alive, conception, and there's been a period of time in which the child is unprotected by our laws, and we think the law ought to protect human life from the time it's identifiably alive. And that was the beginning of the abortion law modernization, which between 1860 and 1875, 1880, every state enacted laws, with the exception of Kentucky, which continued the common law. Well, I recognize that there are some interesting areas here. For instance, you can argue that you don't really know when life begins, in the sense that, well, technically, I don't know. I did some reading a couple of years ago, and it was unclear to me precisely what point in the process of fertilization that independent life comes into being. Or you can say that we're really all a part of life. I mean, life began, if you want to go back and trace it backwards to Adam, that if your grandfather had died, you would not have come into being, or your grandmother, right? So you can say that life is a continuum. But when you're debating the question of whether laws ought to be passed or whether there ought to be legal regulation allowing or prohibiting or regulating or restricting, it seems to me disingenuous, because the same controversy exists on the other end of the spectrum, and that is death. We don't know when death ends. I mean, in the continuum sense, if you have posterity, it continues. And there was a great debate 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, really. You remember the ad hoc committee, the Harvard ad hoc committee, the four criteria for death? Because they'd reached the age of organ transplants. And that was a question that had to be direct. They had to have some objective criteria, something that was usable, that could be employed. Otherwise, we could keep people living on machines indefinitely, and their organs would deteriorate, and they couldn't be transplanted. And so there was a need. The medical community, with a great self-interest, recognized the need, proceeded to say, well, these are the criteria that effectively protect the interests of the terminal person, as well as will not interfere with the progress of medicine. And yet, now that their interests are on the other side of the question, there's a great dishonesty, I believe. Another one is whether the life is human. There was a tremendous debate about 2 years ago, 3 years. Don and I have talked about this before. When there is a human life bill passed in Congress, proposed in Congress, debated in the Senate, in Eastland's, in Senator East's committee, in the Senate on the separation of powers, and the bill would propose to declare, to have Congress find that human life begins at conception. And there was a whole lot of, there was an array of witnesses equally divided, but a lot of very prominent scientists, biologists, doctors came and testified that they didn't know when human life began. And they said, well, look, we're willing to concede that the human organism begins and is alive from the time of conception, but we're not willing to admit that it's human. You see, human is a social term. It's not a medical term. And so for you to say that human life exists from conception is dishonest, because we can't agree with that, because that's beyond our expertise. We're mere doctors. We can only tell you the scientific side. That came from such people as had written textbooks and articles on human reproduction. A bit of a dishonesty there, which I find quite discouraging. Well, I have one other ethical dilemma that I am concerned about, and I'd like to raise here again, thinking it's an appropriate form, and then throw it open for criticism and question. And that is the dilemma of faith. It seems to me that there is often a conflict or a tension. I think tensions are good. Tensions encourage us to keep sharp, and in the search for absolute answers and feeling too comfortable that we have absolute answer, that kind of a setting and that kind of an attitude breeds laziness and sloth, and it breeds abuse and arrogance, and I think that's very bad. But I think that there's a dishonesty in the tension that seeks, or a way to avoid the tension. I'm concerned when there are people who seem to have such a beautiful, genuine understanding of an intangible reality of one sort, call it, if you will, intellect or reason, who understand that intangible reality of reason. I mean, I think everyone here in this room has had the experience of the wonderful experience of discovering reasoning through something, and being able to the reality of that experience is unforgettable, is undeniable, and it's a delicious experience, and it's what takes us back to good literature, takes us back to great authors, keeps us coming back to groups like Sunstone's Symposia in hopes that we'll have that experience again. It's an intangible reality that they recognize and they can understand. So often have and almost refuse to acknowledge the existence or the reality of other intangible realities, and I refer to faith. And I think, again, all of us that have assembled here have had those kinds of experiences that take us back again, searching for more. And yet, often there's a refusal, a ridicule, or a hostility that disturbs and troubles me. I think it's a dishonesty, and it reduces the integrity of the process of reasoning and the intellectual process. Well, I don't claim to be an ethicist. I claim to be a lawyer. But I think that there are ethical issues that all of us face from whatever our backgrounds, medicine and law and business. And when I hear, I have law students every year, I have a class of first-year law students, and inevitably some will raise their question and say, well, how can we do that? That's such a terrible dilemma. How can we represent someone that we know is guilty? And it seems to me that often they overlook equally profound and troubling dilemmas that arise in their own lives in the treatment of their wife or husband or their children or parents. In business, the ethical dilemmas are every bit as profound, but we've sort of fallen into comfortable patterns of dealing with them so that we don't think about them anymore. I'm delighted to be challenged to think about them again. Thank you.
At this point, we'll pull three chairs up here, and the three of us will sit up here and field, hopefully, some questions that you may have. If you have enough, I have several for these people. Go ahead.
Ken, you talked about one issue that I think is becoming very prominent for all of us today, and that's the Milton, versus the other. I'm not a philosopher, but With the political situation that is now and the so-called moral majority attempting to legislate a lot of morality, and you talked about kind of going under the door, do you have any thought on how far you ought to go or how far you ought not to go on legislating morality, things that perhaps are not as damaging to anyone other than the person that's involved, such as drugs, prostitution, homosexuality?
Yes. If you read carefully Lord Devlin's statements on that very issue, he articulates a number of safeguards. He says there are a whole lot of things that the law is just not legal on. On the other hand, when the law always ought to try as far as possible to safeguard reason, he just argues that social values and the impact, the empirical impact on society has some bearing on whether you should try to enforce morals. As I have tried to think about this, I can tell you, for example, that I've looked at the arguments for legalizing prostitution and decided in my own mind that the arguments against legalizing prostitution are stronger. Now, I think Mill's principle would tend to say that prostitution is a classical case of something that is done by consent among adults, generally in private, and we ought to just let them do whatever they want to do. But I think that there are enough concerns about it that I don't want to legalize prostitution. That's my own view. This is just one issue and it's a very big discussion, but on the other hand, I want to be very, very sensitive to Mill's overall feeling that we want to provide for human liberty and freedom as much as possible. So I'm sensitive to that also, and don't think with the moral majority that we just ought to wholesale cut off people's options because somebody has an idea as to what is right once and for all. As I want to balance this very well with human freedom, human liberty, and so on. That's an incredibly difficult task, and it can only be done, I think, issue by issue by issue.
Kent, do you plan on writing the definitive treatise on that topic?
Not high on my priority list right now.
have a question here. Let's have the questioners identify themselves.
I have two questions. I'd like to direct to Mr. Wardle. I'm not sure I got your point where you say the dilemma of faith. What are you talking about? You mentioned the topic, and I'm not sure you developed it. What is the essence of the dilemma?
Well, I really didn't have any topic to develop. I guess I have something on my mind because of an incident that I won't discuss here involving a very close friend of mine. The dilemma is people who the dilemma exists among people who are self-proclaimed intellectuals who deny the reality of faith. Another prominent intellectual, again a man of great talent, great ability that I respect in the state, recently published a few years ago, an interview that I read. In which the essence of the interview was real men don't believe in the Book of Mormon. They don't eat quiche. They don't wash dishes, and they don't believe in the Book of Mormon. And it just troubled me and disappointed me, maybe aggravated me, is a better term.
You use the term dishonest. Is there an honesty issue? If somebody wants to say, that kind of statement, so-and-so, real men don't. I mean, what's dishonest about that? Expression of how you feel, and is honesty
maybe an issue? I meant to talk about honesty in the other context, the honesty of recognizing, admitting facts and ethical issues. Here, it's maybe dishonesty isn't the best term, although I consider it a form of dishonesty, at least an inconsistency, to recognize the reality of intangible. To recognize intangible reality and then deny intangible reality because you can't reason, taste, touch in the field of faith.
Yeah, the second question I have is, do you feel that the BYU law school is better equipped because of its affiliation with a church or the church to produce lawyers who are more ethical than those from other law schools?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'll give you my candid answer, yes. As a result of that, I think we have a great obligation to. I would say yes, not in a narrow sense, because we are from the true church and it is the true law school. yes, because with that kind of backing, with that kind of encouragement, with the environment that the university provides, which says we're concerned with the total person and the total person's contribution to society. We don't want people out of balance. We don't want them to come out that are great scholars and lousy fathers, or great lawyers and lousy wives and mothers. We want them to come out with we don't want them to come out with great technical skill so that they can, in fact, argue their way around any other lawyer or any other law, but willing to sell their technical skills to the highest bidder regardless of the case or cost. It's not unpopular, it's just not a popular position in legal education today. The position that's been predominant for the last 30 years is that we don't look to whether it's good or bad or the outcome. We're simply training technical lawyers. We want lawyers that know how to read and write, who can reason well. We're just concerned with that ability. We don't want to get into whether it's ethical or whether it's good, because who knows what that is. We're a pluralistic society, and law schools ought not to be teaching those sorts of things. They ought to be teaching what is good legal analysis and good legal writing. I think BYU makes a great casemate, the very fact of its existence. Let me give you an example. You touched on one of my favorite topics.
Because I disagree with about everything you're saying. You don't want to ask me the same question.
You have to respond to me. Please, want you to. But I think it's very important. The very fact that the law school exists is recognized and is a good law school. We are a good law school in the sense that entering credentials of our entering law students place us in the top 15 or 20 law schools in the nation out of 170 or so accredited law schools and another 40 unaccredited proprietary law schools. It's a good law school in all objective criteria, so it's not a fly-by-night or an embarrassment level institution. You take an institution that is credible in that sense, got a good library, got a good staff, good credentials, and they've got good student body. Their LSATs and their GPAs rank very, very high, and a good physical facility, and the graduates are doing very well in good law firms. So you've got all of those credentials that say this is a law school that we can't just brush off as the Oral Roberts Law School and Screen Door Company kind of thing. It's a legitimate professional institution of credibility. And they say, hey, we think it's important that we look at what we're doing, how we're using our skills. In the post-Watergate era, that ought to be important to us. It ought to be important to lawyers especially, that people not only gain skill and ability, but that they gain judgment and have a commitment to use that, their ability and their skill, to do good. And not that we're going to reach any great conclusions about what is the good. People that graduate from other law schools may have a higher commitment to poverty law than BYU Law School does, or may have a higher commitment to tax reform. But we ought to be able to train lawyers to go out and say we're interested not in just how we do, but in what we do. I was reading recently Somerset Maugham's classic of Human Bondage, in which he talks about, and there's a passage in there describing the protagonist, Philip Carey's era in Paris as a painter. He's trying to learn painting. He's discussing with one of his teachers, and, well, the bottom line is, technique is nothing. He's always had technique, but he finally discovers after a year or two of studying art that he's never going to be a great artist. Because while he has technique and he can draw, he can be an illustrator anytime he's got that, he doesn't have a message. There's nothing for him to communicate. He doesn't see those greater things that the great artist has seen and communicate with their message. I think that that's what makes the artist is not just and distinguishes an artist from an illustrator. I think that's what distinguishes a lawyer from a law clerk. So yes, I do think the law school does have an obligation and is better equipped than most other law schools, not because we're affiliated with the True Church or because we're the True Law School, but because we want to do that. And that's something that other law schools have not wanted to do for 30 years. And we're seeing a revival of interest in this area. We're seeing professors at other law schools beginning to say, because BYU's accreditation comes up every 7 years, when we're admitted to the American Association of Law Schools, there's a three-year, we're put off on admission for 3 years. While they're debating, can we admit a law school that says they are going to, the religious affiliation is a factor, that they're going to require their students and their faculty to commit to abide by certain moral standards. Can we allow them into our association? That's really very troubling for them. They debate it for 3 years and finally say, well, we can't keep them out because of all of these other objective criteria, which we say are the only things that count. They're better than most of our members, so we've got to let them in. But the fact that they have to wrestle with the problem is a very, very good thing for the profession. I've spoken too long.
So, question here, and then I don't know if you're interested in addressing specific ethical dilemmas. I'm a resident of obstetrics and gynecology. And next year I'm going to be given a fellowship in maternal and fetal medicine, where I will daily be talking to couples who carry genetic traits where they would have a significant chance of their children having bad birth defects. I was wondering if any of you had heard of a discussion in a Mormon context about the ethics of terminating a pregnancy which was diagnosed as involving a severe birth defect, or whether the prohibition of abortion was far-reaching enough that even in those cases it would not be legitimate.
The church recently published a new general handbook of instruction
don't know if you're familiar with that.
Not fit with this thing.
It's kind of a landmark. It was kind of a landmark publication. We heard in the church for a long time that a new handbook was being revised, but none of us ever thought it would appear. It finally did, and it was kind of in a condensed form, much thinner than ever in the past. A lot of us thought maybe the church would touch upon that exact issue, and that has been the most troublesome issue for a lot of LDS people for several years now. But they did not touch on that particular issue. In private, with the physicians that I work with and have worked with, they feel as though, and I'm generalizing without having hard data in front of me, like a survey or something, but most that I talk to feel as though there are some instances that may be justified. They are reluctant to identify each and every genetic anomaly that may justify this. And there is still a great question concerning physician nurse liability in those, religious liability in those particular cases. So that is, I think, the greatest area reproductive ethics in the church today. Not that there are, there's many more, but I think that is the most troublesome right now.
Let me just comment that the latter part of Lynn Wortle's essay in this book on passive euthanasia is relevant to that question. And the only statement that the church has put out on abortion is the 1973 statement, which contains some of these provisions. And I think the real problem is that the church doesn't know what it should say of a general nature, of a principle, a rule nature that would guide us in all the specific decisions. So here are some of the features, and I think this is the best thing that we've got. No definite statement has been made by the Lord one way or the other concerning the crime of abortion. Nevertheless, abortion must be considered one of the most revolting and sinful practices of the day. Third, the church opposes abortion and counsels its members not to submit or perform an abortion except in rare cases. And then there's some specified rare cases, and you've probably seen that statement. And then the out is this. Even then, it should be done only after counseling with local presiding priesthood authority and after receiving divine confirmation through prayer. What the statement says to me is that we don't know what to say about a whole lot of very difficult issues. And the best that we can counsel everybody to do is to make decisions with very great care and deliberation. That's involving prayer and discussing with others and things of that sort.
I should add one thing. In discussing this very issue with nurses and physicians, again, with no formal survey data at my fingertips, there is a feeling that it's difficult to morally justify an abortion just on the basis of Down syndrome problems. But on the more severe genetic problems, possibly.
Let me add, just to continue with what Don and what Ken had said, the 1983 Church Handbook does contain or reprints this statement, which is this identical, unchanged 73 statement. What Ken didn't read were the exceptions. They list two. One is, it says, where on basis of competent medical advice, the life or good health of the mother is seriously endangered. So that's your genuine therapeutic exception. Or where the pregnancy was caused by rape and produced a serious emotional trauma in the mother. So you've got two exceptions. Life, health, rape. And some people, one of the early statements made by President Kimball, I believe it was by President Kimball,
may have been before President Kim, one of the early church statements listed three exceptions that were identical to model penal code exceptions: life or health, rape or incest, felonious intercourse. And the third exception was serious genetic defect, essentially. And that's what you're asking. That statement was once made by the church, but it's no longer made. In fact, the film, The Church of Tao, one of the films, has a girl who was born, her mother was pregnant and had rubella, and there was a high risk. But of course, you're talking about something different. You're not talking about just risk. You're talking about
diagnosis
or maybe amniocentesis or something like that. That's a tremendous limit. I didn't take in my talk, I told about the dishonesty of, on one side. Even after you acknowledge that the fetus is living and is human, you still haven't answered the legal question of should we protect the life or should we disallow the destruction. And you have to recognize that the law has always allowed killing living human beings for a variety of reasons, but they're always forthrightly addressed: self-defense, war. And those are situations in which there's a lot of tension, a lot of discussion. It's not just a matter of whim or arbitrary will or caprice. It's a matter of great moral tension and a whole lot of discussion. Cannibalism, necessary. The great Rex versus Bourne, that was the cannibal case of the two sailors ate the third to stay alive. Okay, is that justifiable killing? Anyway, this is a very difficult area, and I personally, I think that the law ought to be written, and there ought to be allowed more abortion than I would personally think is justifiable, because this is such a troubling area. You have to have room to respect the moral beliefs and plurality and pluralistic society of others. But that's a different question than what people professing a particular standard should do. That's a little narrower question, and the church has explicitly declined to include in the exceptions the genetic defect. There's a doctor up at the U of U. I presume you're at the U of U. Who's the doctor that teaches in this area?
Bob Feynman.
Feynman, yeah. Good doctor. Again, I have engaged in debate with him on one occasion in which he repeated an article that is one of the most scandalous pieces of rags that I've ever read, which he attempts to paint the abortion controversy as a Catholic controversy. And I had a great Catholic scholar with me at the time, John Noonan, who got up and at the top of his lungs, so aggravated that this Dr. Feynman was quoting some supposed saint who lived in the 1300s, and said, look, this guy's a Catholic scholar of worldwide renown, and said, I've never heard of that person. What are you saying that's the reason for the Catholic doctrine today? He essentially was saying that Catholics don't allow abortion because they want to baptize and then let some souls go to hell. And it was really... But Feynman raises some troubling issues, and he's a very interesting person to talk with when he's fixed to the medical.
What this reveals is that frequently the technology has run ahead of our deliberation on values. And I think that we need to always go slowly in trying to reorient and reorder our values and do it cautiously. But there are a whole lot of issues that the Mormons simply have not addressed. One of the things that I can tell you just personally worries me about the widespread use of amniocentesis is the capability of determining the sex of the child. Now, in a society in which male and females are equally valued, I wouldn't worry about that, but my suspicion is that they're not equally valued in our own society and most of the societies of the world. And the technique allows people, even in China, where male children are highly prized, to make decisions that I don't think humans ought to be making.
One last comment. Bob Feynman has a letter, possibly more than one, in his possession from I know at least one general authority, which he privately said, well, in certain gross anomaly cases, abortion would be acceptable, although you'll never see that in official print. at least not today. But you might ask Bob to share some of those letters with you.
I think the reason that you don't have an official church position is an awfully good thing. I'm glad that we're taught to struggle it out and reason it out for ourselves in most cases, and develop our own good judgment, listen to the whisperings of the Spirit, and develop our own capacity to reason and to rather than simply rely on authority. We get some general principles, and then we're supposed to struggle.
An issue is what the general principles are.
Yeah.
Next question, right here.
Oh, well, I was going to go back to his and Ralph Batman kind of, but I just got back to BYU, I think, in 1994, it was very good, but I'm very skeptical of it, because in my long life, I noticed that Mormons had a tendency to be treaty underlined, and I noticed that the authors are not. And even some of the graduates or some of their students in BYU, they're back in Washington, I don't tend to agree with any more than ordinary people. So I think the idealism there is great. I hope it works. I haven't seen evidence of it yet. I've got a lawyer son who lost all the healing during the home discussion. I'm very skeptical about it.
Yes.
But I do think it's idealistic.
The article in this book that made me the most angry was written by a member of the BYU law school. And what made me angry about it was that it seemed to me that it ran counter to the charge given by Dallin Oaks here in the book, and it ran counter to my own Mormon values, that we are simply not trying to mutually manipulate each other. And a very cynical article about the use of rhetoric.
Well, it should be very interesting to get two BYU graduates in the same court. I would like to be there.
A question here.
My question relates to that. Ken, as you were discussing that, you mentioned that Doug Parker had quoted from A.J. Ayer.
Yes.
Is that out of date now? I'm not that up to date on philosophy.
Yeah, it is. That book has gradually, over the last 30 years, been repudiated by philosophers. People just found too many problems with it. And the emotive theory of ethics, there is an element that's interesting in that, but it doesn't give one a comprehensive, balanced view of ethics. There are a lot of other problems with the book. The verification principle just doesn't work out. So it's a book that threw out metaphysics, and it threw out political philosophy, and it threw out ethics and so on as being unscientific. We'll put those on the garbage heap of history. But all of those things have sneaked back in the back door, and they had to, because it was simply a dogmatic bias on the part of the logical positivists, including Ayer, that one threw them out the front door. And it was a bias that they couldn't sustain on their own principles. The verifiability principle criterion of meaningfulness is itself not verifiable in the terms that they specify.
Let me, I'm going to have to bring things to a close here. We're at the end. Let me take 1 minute and just impart a concluding comment, sort of a confession of a Mormon ethicist. My question right now is where do we go from here as Mormon moral thinkers and writers? For about the last 5 years, there's been kind of a renaissance in this area, and I guess I've been part or one of those people in the Renaissance. There have been several lectures in this symposium on ethics. There is every time Peggy puts one of these together. More so, do you remember this occurring 10 years ago, Kent? I don't think it's relatively new. And as I've pondered with, you know, another writing project myself, I think, well, what do I want to do? Is there really such a thing in the church, or is there a place for systematic moral theology? I've heard a lot of critical comment in these symposiums in the past about, no, we do not want systematic theology in the church. Well, what about systematic is just a logical expose covering every point very clearly. Well, some, you know, I've heard the argument's pro and con.
Well, and I'm not going to make many, but some of our, well, I think we need to expose the ethics of things. I think we're weak on that.
What I've been personally deliberating, really agonizing over, is how to theoretically make the connections between personal ethics, my own personal moral philosophy, social ethics, which includes a whole different milieu of economics and law and a lot of other things, and professional ethics. What are the principles? What's the framework that's going to tie those areas together to make a comprehensible whole? Or do we even want a comprehensible whole, a framework that can connect those three together? Intuitively, I say yes, because I guess I've been trained in the rational school of thought for many years. But I haven't totally made up my mind, and I'm not sure that anyone has the time and the financial resources to sit down for 5 years and write a definitive treatise that will tie these three areas together. I don't have the time. I don't think Kent does. But it would be delightful, I believe, to have some things to work on like that. Right now we have an article here, we have an article there, presentation here, presentation there. And maybe it's going to be left up to someone a little brighter than myself or others to put this thing together, sort of the Ludwig Wittgenstein of Mormon ethics in 1987, maybe. What a lot of us have tried to do is simply provide some insights into what some moral philosophers in the church are thinking. And now we have almost a critical mass of information to read and to study to try to identify what ideas are currently in the minds of those individuals. And I'm grateful for that personally. It's helped me a great deal to sort out where I want to go in my own moral research. I know BYU has a moral, ethical research project going. Maren Morrison was over that. I don't know if she still is or not, but why. She very much wanted to be with us on the panel today to discuss with you what is going on in that regard at the Y. Right now, it's a group of psychologists that are involved in that, and I don't know what the result in the next year or two will be from that perspective.
I think this particular year, philosophers like Dr. Lee, now gone to the university, and the philosophers who get together and have that discussion. And I know I sat in his classes, and we used to spend class after class on what is right and what is wrong and what is moral and what is God. And yet he accepted himself as not accepted in full capacity by our church. And he's on the basis of life and business. Of course, Lowell Bingham, too, is a guy. We ought to get them up there and have some panels and start out this truly ethical and moral dilemma that's in our church. We're too materialistic. And I get that from every angle of my association, like if I worked on PCA Club or Neighborhood Coverage Committee, you want to be materialistic. Now, is that right? And no, I think we ought to ask Crystal.
Probably not right, but it's true.
we ought to sit down and discuss it and make it
You're right, very much so. Where?
Thank you. Hi. Hello. My name is Dave Green.
Dave, how are you?
Have you attended any of the ethics symposiums or sort of the university by the Department of Philosophy in the school?
We have.